At Kokubunji Station, a group of elderly people dressed in hiking gear got on. There were 10 of them altogether, 5 men and 5 women in their late 60s and early 70s. They carried backpacks and wore hats and were chattering away like schoolchildren. All carried water bottles, some strapped to their waists, others tucked into the pockets of their backpacks. Tengo wondered if he could possibly reach that age with such a sense of enjoyment. Then he shook his head. No way. He imagined these old folks standing proudly on some mountaintop, drinking from their water bottles. In spite of their small size, the little people drank prodigious amounts of water. They preferred to drink rainwater or water from the nearby stream rather than tap water. And so the girl would scoop water from the stream during daylight hours and give it to the little people to drink. Whenever it rained, she would collect water in a bucket because the little people preferred rainwater to water gathered from the stream. They were therefore grateful for the girl's kindness. Tengo noticed he was having trouble staying focused on any one thought. This was not a good sign. He felt an internal confusion starting. An ominous sandstorm was developing somewhere on the plane of his emotions. This often happened on Sundays. "Is something wrong?" Fukaeri asked without a question mark. She seemed able to sense the tension that Tengo was feeling. "I wonder if I can do it."
"Do what?"
"If I can say what I need to say."
"Say what you need to say?" Fukaeri asked. She seemed to be having trouble understanding what he meant.
"To the professor."
"Say what you need to say to the professor," she repeated.
After some hesitation, Tengo confessed, "I keep thinking that things are not going to go smoothly, that everything is going to fall apart," he said.
Fukaeri turned in her seat until she was looking directly at Tengo.
"Afraid?" she asked.
"What am I afraid of?" Tengo rephrased her question. She nodded silently.
"Maybe I'm just afraid of meeting new people, especially on a Sunday morning."
"Why Sunday?" Fukaeri asked.
Tengo's armpits started sweating. He felt a suffocating tightness in his chest. Meeting new people and having new things thrust upon him, and having his present existence threatened by them.
"Why Sunday?" Fukaeri asked again.
Tengo recalled his boyhood Sundays. After they had walked all day, his father would take him to the restaurant across from the station and tell him to order anything he liked. It was a kind of reward for him, and virtually the only time the frugal pair would eat out. His father would even order a beer, though he almost never drank. Despite the offer, Tengo never felt the slightest bit hungry on these occasions. Ordinarily, he was hungry all the time, but he never enjoyed anything he ate on Sunday. To eat every mouthful of what he had ordered, which he was absolutely required to do, was nothing but torture for him. Sometimes he even came close to vomiting. This was what Sunday meant for Tengo as a boy. Fukaeri looked into Tengo's eyes in search of something. Then she reached out and took his hand. This startled him, but he tried not to let it show on his face. Fukaeri kept her gentle grip on Tengo's hand until the train arrived in Kunitachi Station near the end of the line. Her hand was unexpectedly hard and smooth, neither hot nor cold. It was maybe half the size of Tengo's hand.
"Don't be afraid. It's not just another Sunday," she said, as if stating a well-known fact.
Tengo thought this might have been the first time he heard her speak two sentences at once.
Chapter 9. Aomame. New Scenery, New Rules. Aomame went to the ward library closest to home. At the reference desk, she requested the compact edition of the newspaper for the 3-month period from September to November 1981. The clerk pointed out that they had such editions for 4 newspapers, the Asahi, the Yomiuri, the Mainichi, and the Nikkei, and asked which she preferred. The bespectacled middle-aged woman seemed less a regular librarian than a housewife doing part-time work. She was not especially fat, but her wrists were puffy, almost ham-like. All Mama said she didn't care which newspaper they gave her to read. They were all pretty much the same. That may be true, but I really need you to decide which you would like, the woman said in a flat voice, meant to repel any further argument. Our Mama had no intention of arguing, so she chose the Mainichi, for no special reason. Sitting in a cubicle, she opened her notebook, and ballpoint pen in hand, started scanning one article after another. No especially major events had occurred in the early autumn of 1981. Charles and Diana had married that July, and the after effects were still in evidence. Reports on where they went, what they did, what she wore, what her accessories were like. Ah, Mama, of course, knew about the wedding, but she had no particular interest in it, and she could not figure out why people were so deeply concerned about the fate of an English prince and princess. Charles looked less like a prince than a high school physics teacher with stomach trouble. In Poland, Lech Wałęsa's Solidarity Movement was deepening its confrontation with the government, and the Soviet government was expressing its concern. More directly, the Soviets were threatening to send in tanks, just as they had prior to the year 1968, Prague Spring, if Polish government failed to bring things under control. Ah, Mama generally remembered these events as well. She knew that the Soviet government eventually gave up any thought of interfering in the situation, so there was no need for her to read these articles closely. One thing did catch her attention, though. When President Reagan issued a declaration meant to discourage the Soviets from intervening in Polish internal affairs, he was quoted as saying, "We hope that the tense situation in Poland will not interfere with joint U.S.-Soviet plans to construct a moon base." Construct a moon base? She had never heard of such a plan. Come to think of it, though, there had been some mention of that on the TV news the other day. That night when she had sex with the balding middle-aged man from Kansai in the Akasaka Hotel. On September 20th, the world's largest kite-flying competition took place in Jakarta, with more than 10,000 participants. Almame was unfamiliar with that particular bit of news, but there was nothing strange about it. Who would remember news about a giant kite-flying competition held in Jakarta 3 years ago? On October 6th, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was assassinated by radical Islamic terrorists. Almame recalled the event with renewed pity for Sadat. She had always been fond of Sadat's bald head, and she felt only revulsion for any kind of religious fundamentalists. The very thought of such people's intolerant worldview, their inflated sense of their own superiority, and their callous imposition of their own beliefs on others was enough to fill her with rage. Her anger was almost uncontrollable. But this had nothing to do with the problem she was now confronting. She took several deep breaths to calm her nerves, and then she turned the page. On October 12th, in a residential section of the Itabashi ward of Tokyo, an NHK subscription fee collector, aged 56, became involved in a shouting match with a college student who refused to pay. Pulling out the butcher knife he always carried in his briefcase, he stabbed the student in the abdomen, wounding him seriously. The police rushed to the scene and arrested him on the spot. The collector was standing there in a daze with the bloody knife in his hand. He offered no resistance. According to one of his fellow collectors, the man had been a full-time staff member for 6 years and was an extremely serious worker with an outstanding record. Almame had no recollection of such an event. She always took the Yomiuri newspaper and read it from cover to cover, paying close attention to the human interest stories, especially those involving crimes, which comprised fully half the human interest stories in the evening edition. There was almost no way she could have failed to read an article as long as this one. Of course, something could have come up that caused her to miss it, but this was very unlikely. Unlikely, but not unthinkable. She knit her brow and mulled over the possibility that she could have missed such a report. Then she recorded the date in her notebook with a summary of the event. The collector's name was Shinosuke Akutagawa. Impressive. Sounded like the literary giant Ryosuke Akutagawa. There was no photograph of the collector, only of the man he stabbed, Akira Tagawa, age 21. Tagawa was a third-year student in the undergraduate law program of Nihon University and a second-rank practitioner of Japanese swordsmanship. Had he been holding a bamboo practice sword at the time, the collector would not have been able to stab him so easily. But ordinary people do not hold bamboo swords in hand when they talk to NHK fee collectors. Of course, ordinary NHK fee collectors don't walk around with butcher knives in their briefcases either. Aomame followed the next several days' worth of reports on the case, but found nothing to indicate that the student had died. He had probably survived. On October 16th, there had been a major accident at a coal mine in Yubari, Hokkaido. A fire broke out at the extraction point 1,000 meters underground, and more than 50 miners suffocated. The fire spread upward toward the surface, and another 10 men died. To prevent the fire from spreading further, the company pumped the mine full of water without first ascertaining the whereabouts of the remaining miners. The final death toll rose to 93. This was a heart-rending event. Coal was a dirty energy source, and its extraction was dangerous work. Mining companies were slow to invest in safety equipment, and working conditions were terrible. Accidents were common, and miners' lungs were destroyed. But there were many people and businesses that required coal because it was cheap. Aomame had a clear memory of this accident. The aftermath of the Yubari coal mine accident was still being reported in the paper when Aomame found the event that she was looking for. It had occurred on October 19th, 1981. Not until Tomaru told her about it several hours earlier was Aomame aware that such an incident had ever happened. This was simply unimaginable. The headline appeared on the front page of the morning edition in large type. Yamanashi gunfight with radicals. Three officers die. A large photo accompanied the article, an aerial shot of the location where the battle had occurred near Lake Motosu, in the hills of Yamanashi Prefecture. There was also a simple map of the site, which was in the mountains away from the developed area of lakeside vacation homes. There were three portrait photos of the dead officers from the Yamanashi Prefectural Police, a self-defense force special paratroop unit dispatched by helicopter, camouflage fatigues, sniper rifles with scopes, short-barreled automatics. Aomame scowled hugely. In order to express her feelings properly, she stretched every muscle in her face as far as it would go. Thanks to the partitions on either side of her, no one else sitting at the library tables was able to witness her startling transformation. She then took a deep breath, sucking in all the surrounding air that she possibly could, and letting every bit of it out, like a whale rising to the surface to exchange all the air in its giant lungs. The sound startled the high school student studying at the table behind her, his back to hers, and he spun around to look at her. But he said nothing. He was just frightened. After distorting her face for a while, Aomame made an effort to relax each of her facial muscles until she had resumed a normal expression. For a long time after that, she tapped at her front teeth with the top end of her ballpoint pen and tried to organize her thoughts. There ought to be a reason. There has to be a reason. How could I have overlooked such a major event, one that shook the whole of Japan? And this incident is not the only one. I didn't know anything about the NHK fee collector stabbing of the college student. It's absolutely mystifying. I couldn't possibly have missed one major thing after another. I'm too observant, too meticulous for that. I know when something's off by a millimeter, and I know my memory is strong. The This is why, in sending a number of men to the other side, I've never made a single mistake. This is why I've been able to survive. I read the newspaper carefully every day, and when I say read the newspaper carefully, that means never missing anything that is in any way significant. The newspaper continued for days to devote major space to the Lake Motosu incident. The Self-Defense Force and the Yamanashi Prefectural Police chased down 10 escaped radicals, staging a large-scale manhunt in the surrounding hills, killing 3 of them, severely wounding 2, and arresting 4, one of whom turned out to be a woman. The last person remained unaccounted for. The paper was filled with reports on the incident, completely obliterating any follow-up reports on the NHK fee collector who stabbed the college student in Itabashi Ward. Though no one at NHK ever said so, of course, the broadcasters must have been extremely relieved, for if something like the Lake Motosu incident had not occurred, the media would almost certainly have been screaming about the NHK collection system or raising doubts about the very nature of NHK's quasi-governmental status. At the beginning of that year, information on the ruling Liberal Democratic Party's objection to an NHK special on the Lockheed scandal was leaked, exposing how the NHK had, in response, changed some of the content. After these revelations, much of the nation was, quite reasonably, beginning to doubt the autonomy of NHK programming and to question its political fairness. This, in turn, gave added impetus to a campaign against paying NHK subscription fees. Aside from the Lake Motosu incident and the incident involving the NHK fee collector, Almame clearly remembered the other events and incidents and accidents that had occurred at the time, and she clearly remembered having read all the newspaper reports about them. Only in those 2 cases did her powers of recall seem to fail her. Why should that be? Why should there be absolutely nothing left in her memory from those 2 events alone? Even supposing this is all due to some malfunction in my brain, could I possibly have erased those 2 matters so cleanly, leaving everything else intact? Almame closed her eyes and pressed her fingertips against her temples hard. Maybe such a thing is, in fact, possible. Maybe my brain is giving rise to some kind of function that is trying to remake reality, that singles out certain news stories and throws a black cloth over them to keep me from seeing or remembering them. The police department switched to new guns and uniforms, the construction of a joint U.S.-Soviet moon base, an NHK fee collector stabbing of a college student, a fierce gun battle at Lake Mototsu between a radical group and a special detachment of the Self-Defense Force. But what do any of these things have in common? Nothing at all, as far as I can see. Almame continued tapping on her teeth with the top end of her ballpoint pen as her mind spun furiously. She kept this up for a long time until finally the thought struck her. Maybe I can look at it this way. The problem is not with me, but with the world around me. It's not that my consciousness or mind has given rise to some abnormality, but rather that some kind of incomprehensible power has caused the world around me to change. The more she thought about it, the more natural her second hypothesis began to feel to her, because no matter how much she searched for it, she could not find in herself a gap or distortion in her mind. And so she carried this hypothesis forward. It's not me, but the world that's deranged. Yes, that settles it. At some point in time, the world I knew either vanished or withdrew, and another world came to take its place, like the switching of a track. In other words, my mind, here and now, belongs to the world that was, but the world itself has already changed into something else. So far, the actual changes carried out in that process are limited in number. Most of the new world has been retained from the world I knew, which is why the changes have presented, virtually, no impediments to my daily life. So far, But the changes that have already taken place will almost certainly create other, greater differences around me as time goes by. Those differences will expand little by little and will, in some cases, destroy the logicality of the actions I take. They could well cause me to commit errors that are, for me, literally fatal. Parallel worlds. Almama scowled as if she had bitten into something horribly sour, though the scowl was not as extreme as the earlier one. She started tapping her ballpoint pen against her teeth again and released a deep groan. The high school student behind her heard it rattle in her throat, but this time pretended not to hear. This is starting to sound like science fiction. Am I just making up a self-serving hypothesis as a form of self-defense? Maybe it's just that I've gone crazy. I see my own mind as perfectly normal, as free of distortion. But don't all mental patients insist that they are perfectly fine, and it's the world around them that is crazy? Aren't I just proposing the wild hypothesis of parallel worlds as a way to justify my own madness? This calls for the detached opinion of a third party. But going to a psychiatrist for analysis is out of the question. The situation is far too complicated for that, and there's too much that I can't talk about. Take my recent work, for example, which, without a doubt, is against the law. I mean, I've been secretly killing men with a homemade ice pick. I couldn't possibly tell a doctor about that, even if the men themselves have been utterly despicable, twisted individuals. Even supposing I could successfully conceal my illegal activities, the legal parts of the life I've led since birth could hardly be called normal either. My life is like a trunk stuffed with dirty laundry. It contains more than enough material to drive any one human being to mental aberration. Maybe two or three people's worth. My sex life alone would do it. It's nothing I could talk about to anyone. No, I can't go to a doctor. I have to solve this on my own. Let me pursue this hypothesis a little further if I can. If something like this has actually happened, if, that is, this world I'm standing in now has in fact taken the place of the old one, then when, where, and how did the switching of the tracks occur, in the most concrete sense? Almama made another concentrated effort to work her way back through her memory. She had first become aware of the changes in the world a few days earlier, when she took care of the oil field development specialist in a hotel room in Shibuya. She had left her taxi on the elevated Metropolitan Expressway No. 3, climbed down an emergency escape stairway to Route 246, changed her stockings, and headed for Sanjanjaya Station on the Tokyu Line. On the way to the station, she passed a young policeman and noticed for the first time that something about his appearance was different. That's when it all started. Which means the world switched tracks just before that. The policeman I saw near home that morning was wearing the same old uniform and carrying an old-fashioned revolver. Almama recalled the odd sensations she had felt when she heard the opening of Janacek's Sinfonietta in the taxi caught in traffic. She had experienced it as a kind of physical wrenching, as if the components of her body were being wrung out like a rag. Then the driver told me about the Metropolitan Expressway's emergency stairway. I took off my high heels and climbed down. The entire time I climbed down that precarious stairway in my stocking feet with the wind tearing at me, the opening fanfare of Janacek's Sinfonietta echoed on and off in my ears. That may have been when it started, she thought. There had been something strange about that taxi driver, too. Almama still remembered his parting words. She reproduced them as precisely as she could in her mind. After you do something like that, the everyday look of things might seem to change a little. Things may look different to you than they did before. But don't let appearances fool you. There's always only one reality. At the time, Almama had found this odd, but she had had no idea what he was trying to tell her, so she hadn't given it much thought. She had been in too much of a hurry to puzzle over riddles. Thinking back on it now, though, his remarks had come out of nowhere, and they were truly strange. They could be taken as cautionary advice or an evocative message. What was he trying to convey to me? And then there was the Janáček music. How was I able to tell instantly that it was Janáček's Sinfonietta? And how did I know it was composed in 1926? Janáček's Sinfonietta is not such popular music that anyone can recognize it on hearing the first few bars. Nor have I ever been such a passionate fan of classical music. I can't tell Haydn from Beethoven. Yet the moment it came flowing through the car radio, I knew what it was. Why was that? And why should it have given me such an intensely physical and intensely personal jolt? Yes, that jolt was utterly personal. It felt as if something had awakened a memory that had been asleep inside me for years. Something seemed to grab my shoulder and shake me, which means I might have had a deep connection with that music at some point in my life. The music started playing, threw an automatic switch to on, and perhaps some kind of memory came fully awake. Janáček's Sinfonietta. But though she tried to probe her memory, Ah Mame could come up with nothing else. She looked around, stared at her palms, inspected the shape of her fingernails, and grabbed her breasts through her shirt to check the shape. No change. Same size and shape. I'm still the same me. The world is still the same world, but something has started to change. She could feel it. It was like looking for differences between two identical pictures. Two pictures hang on the wall side by side. They look exactly alike, even with careful comparison. But when you examine the tiniest details, minuscule differences become apparent. Ah Mame switched mental gears, turned the page of the compact edition newspaper, and started taking detailed notes on the gun battle at Lake Motosu. There was speculation that the 5 Chinese-made Kalashnikov AK-47s had been smuggled in through the Korean Peninsula. They were most likely used military surplus, in fairly good condition, and came with lots of ammunition. The Japan Sea's coast was a long one, bringing in weapons and ammunition under cover of night, and using a spy ship disguised as a fishing vessel was not that difficult. That was how drugs and weapons were brought into Japan in exchange for massive quantities of Japanese yen. The Yamanashi Prefectural Police had been unaware that the radicals were so heavily armed. They obtained a search warrant on the purely pro forma charge of inflicting bodily injury, and were carrying only their usual weapons when they piled into 2 patrol cars and a minibus and headed for the farm. This was the headquarters of a group that called itself Akebono, or First Light. On the face of it, the group members were simply operating an organic farm. They refused to allow the police to search their property. A confrontation ensued, and at some point, it turned into a gun battle. The Akebono group owned high-powered Chinese-made hand grenades, which fortunately they did not use, purely because they had obtained the grenades so recently that they had not had time to learn how to operate them. If the radicals had used hand grenades, casualties among the police and the self-defense force would almost certainly have been much greater. Initially, the police did not even bring bulletproof vests with them. Critics singled out the police authorities' poor intelligence analysis and the department's aging weaponry. What most shocked people, however, was the very fact that there still survived in Japan such an armed radical group operating so actively beneath the surface. The late 60s bombastic calls for revolution were already a thing of the past, and everyone assumed that the remnants of the radicals had been wiped out in the police siege of the Asama Mountain Lodge in 1972. When she had finished taking all her notes, Ah Mame returned the compact newspaper to the reference counter. Choosing a thick book called Composers of the World from the music section, She returned to her table and opened the book to Janáček. Lajos Janáček was born in a village in Moravia in 1854 and died in 1928. The article included a picture of him in his later years. Far from bald, his head was covered by a healthy thatch of white hair. It was so thick that Almame couldn't tell much about the shape of his head. Sinfonietta was composed in 1926. Janáček had endured a loveless marriage, but in 1917, at the age of 63, he met and fell in love with a married woman named Camilla. He had been suffering through a slump, but his encounter with Camilla brought back a vigorous creative urge, and he published one late career masterpiece after another. He and Camilla were walking in a park one day when they came across an outdoor concert and stopped to listen. Janáček felt a surge of joy go through his entire body, and the motif for his Sinfonietta came to him. Something seemed to snap in his head, he recounted years later, and he felt enveloped in ecstasy. By chance, he had been asked around that time to compose a fanfare for a major athletic event. The motif that came to him in the park and the motif of the fanfare became one, and Sinfonietta was born. The small symphony label is ordinary enough, but the structure is utterly non-traditional, combining the radiant brass of the festive fanfare with the gentle Central European string ensemble to produce a unique mood. Almame took careful notes on the commentary and the biographical factual material, but the book gave no hint as to what kind of connection there was, or could have been, between herself and this Sinfonietta. She left the library and wandered aimlessly through the streets as evening approached, often talking to herself or shaking her head. Of course, it's all just a hypothesis, Almame told herself as she walked. But it's the most compelling hypothesis I can produce at the moment. I'll have to act according to this one, I suppose, until a more compelling hypothesis comes along. Otherwise, it could end up being thrown to the ground somewhere. If only for that reason, I'd better give an appropriate name to this new situation in which I find myself. There's a need, too, for a special name in order to distinguish between this present world and the former world in which the police carried old-fashioned revolvers. Even cats and dogs need names. A newly changed world must need one, too. 1Q84. That's what I'll call this new world, Almame decided. Q is for question mark. A world that bears a question. Almame nodded to herself as she walked along. Like it or not, I'm here now, in the year 1Q84. The 1984 that I knew no longer exists. It's 1Q84 now. The air has changed, the scene has changed. I have to adapt to this world with a question mark as soon as I can. Like an animal released into a new forest. In order to protect myself and survive, I have to learn the rules of this place and adapt myself to them. Almame went to a record store near Jugaoka Station to look for Janáček's Sinfonietta. Janáček was not a very popular composer. The Janáček section was quite small, and only one record contained Sinfonietta, a version with George Sell conducting the Cleveland Orchestra. The A side was Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra. She knew nothing about these performances, but since there was no other choice, she bought the LP. She went back to her apartment, took a bottle of Chablis from the refrigerator and opened it, placed the record on the turntable, and lowered the needle into the groove. Drinking the well-chilled wine, she listened to the music. It started with the same bright fanfare. This was the music she had heard in the cab. Without a doubt. She closed her eyes and gave the music her complete concentration. The performance was not bad, but nothing happened. It was just music playing. She felt no wrenching of her body, Her perceptions underwent no metamorphosis. After listening to the piece all the way through, she returned the record to its jacket, sat down on the floor, and leaned against the wall drinking wine. Alone and absorbed in her thoughts, she could hardly taste the wine. She went to the bathroom sink, washed her face with soap and water, trimmed her eyebrows with a small pair of scissors, and cleaned her ears with a cotton swab. Either I'm funny or the world's funny. I don't know which. The bottle and lid don't fit. It could be the bottle's fault or the lid's fault. In either case, there's no denying that the fit is bad. Almama opened her refrigerator and examined its contents. She hadn't been shopping for 2 days, so there wasn't much to see. She took out a ripe papaya, cut it in two, and ate it with a spoon. Next, she took out 3 cucumbers, washed them, and ate them with mayonnaise, taking the time to chew slowly. Then she drank a glass of soy milk. That was her entire dinner. It was a simple meal, but ideal for preventing constipation. Constipation was one of the things she hated most in the world, on par with despicable men who commit domestic violence and narrow-minded religious fundamentalists. When she was through eating, Almame got undressed and took a hot shower. Stepping out, she dried herself off and looked at her naked body in the full-length mirror on the back of the door. Flat stomach, firm muscles, lopsided breasts, pubic hair like a poorly tended soccer field. Observing her nakedness, she suddenly recalled that she would be turning 30 in another week. Another damn birthday. To think I'm going to have my 30th birthday in this incomprehensible world of all places. She knit her brows. 1Q84. That was where she was now.
Chapter 10. Tengo. A real revolution with real bloodshed. Transfer, Fukairi said. Then she took Tengo's hand again. This was just before the train pulled into Tachikawa Station. They stepped off the train and walked down one set of stairs and up another to a different platform. Fukairi never once let go of Tengo's hand. They probably looked like a pair of fond lovers to the people around them. There was quite an age difference, but Tengo looked younger than his actual age. Their size difference also probably amused some onlookers. A happy Sunday morning date in the spring. Through the hand holding his, however, Tengo felt no hint of affection for the opposite sex. The strength of her grip never changed. Her fingers had something like the meticulous professionalism of a doctor taking a patient's pulse. It suddenly occurred to Tengo, perhaps this girl thinks we can communicate wordlessly through the touch of fingers and palms. But even supposing such communication had actually taken place, it was all traveling in one direction rather than back and forth. Fukairi's palm might well be absorbing what was in Tengo's mind, but that didn't mean that Tengo could read Fukairi's mind. This did not especially worry Tengo, however. There was nothing in his mind, no thoughts or feelings, that he would be concerned to have her know. Even if she has no feeling for me as a member of the opposite sex, she must like me to some extent, Tengo surmised, or at least she must not have a bad impression of me. Otherwise, whatever her purpose, she wouldn't go on holding my hand like this for such a long time. Having changed now to the platform for the Oume line, they boarded the waiting train. This station, Tachikawa, was the beginning of the Oume line, which headed yet farther toward the hills northwest of Tokyo. The car was surprisingly crowded, full of old folks and family groups in Sunday hiking gear. Tengo and Fukairi stood near the door. We seem to have joined an outing, Tengo said, scanning the crowd. Is it okay to keep holding your hand? Fukairi asked Tengo. She had not let go even after they boarded the train. That's fine, Tengo said. Of course. Fukairi seemed relieved and went on holding his hand. Her fingers and palm were as smooth as ever and free of sweat. They still seemed to be trying to find and verify something inside him. You're not afraid anymore, she asked without a question mark. No, I'm not, Tengo answered. He was not lying. His Sunday morning panic attack had certainly lost its force, thanks perhaps to Fukaeri's holding his hand. He was no longer sweating, nor could he hear his heart pounding. The hallucination paid him no visit, and his breathing was as calm as usual. Good, she said, without inflection. Yes, good, Tengo also thought. There was a simple, rapidly spoken announcement that the train would soon depart, and the train doors rumbled closed, sending an outsized shudder through the train, as if some huge, ancient animal were waking itself from a long sleep. As though it had finally made up its mind, the train pulled slowly away from the platform. Still holding hands with Fukaeri, Tengo watched the scenery go past the train window. At first, it was just the usual residential area scenery, but the farther they went, the more the flat Musashino plain gave way to views of distant mountains. After nearly a dozen stops, the two-track line narrowed down to a single line of rails, and they had to transfer to a four-car train. The surrounding mountains were becoming increasingly prominent. Now they had gone beyond commuting distance from downtown Tokyo. The hills out here retained the withered look of winter, which brought out the brilliance of the evergreens. The smell of the air was different, too, Tengo realized, as the train doors opened at each new station, and sounds were subtly different. Fields lay by the tracks, and farmhouses increased in number. Pickup trucks seemed to outnumber sedans. We've really come a long way, Tengo thought. How far do we have to go? Don't worry, Fukaeri said, as if she had read his mind. Tengo nodded silently. I don't know. It feels like I'm going to meet her parents to ask for her hand in marriage, he thought. Finally, after five stops on the single-track section of the line, they got off at a station called Futamatao. Tengo had never heard of the place before. What a strange name. Forked Tail. The small station was an old wooden building. Five other passengers got off with them. No one got on. People came to Futamatao to breathe the clean air on the mountain trails, not to see a performance of Man of La Mancha, or go to a disco with a wild reputation, or visit an Aston Martin showroom, or eat gratin de homard at a famous French restaurant. That much was obvious from the clothing of the passengers who left the train here. There were virtually no shops by the station, and no people. There was, however, one taxi parked there. It probably showed up whenever a train was scheduled to arrive. Fukaeri tapped on the window, and the rear door opened. She ducked inside and motioned for Tengo to follow her. The door closed. Fukaeri told the driver briefly where she wanted to go, and he nodded in response. They were not in the taxi very long, but the route was tremendously complicated. They went up one steep hill and down another along a narrow farm road where there was barely enough room to squeeze past other vehicles. The number of curves and corners was beyond counting, but the driver hardly slowed down for any of them. Tengo clutched the door's grip in terror. The taxi finally came to a stop after climbing a hill as frighteningly steep as a ski slope on what seemed to be the peak of a small mountain. It felt less like a taxi trip than a spin on an amusement park ride. Tengo produced 2,000 yen bills from his wallet and received his change and receipt in return. A black Mitsubishi Pajero and a large green Jaguar were parked in front of the old Japanese house. The Pajero was shiny and new, but the Jaguar was an old model so coated with white dust that its color was almost obscured. It seemed not to have been driven in some time. The air was startlingly fresh, and a stillness filled the surrounding space. It was a stillness so profound one had to adjust one's hearing to it. The perfectly clear sky seemed to soar upward, and the warmth of the sunlight gently touched any skin directly exposed to it. Tengo heard the high, unfamiliar cry of a bird now and then, but he could not see the bird itself. The house was large and elegant. It had obviously been built long ago, but it was well cared for. The trees and bushes in the front yard were beautifully trimmed. Several of the trees were so perfectly shaped and matched that they looked like plastic imitations. One large pine cast a broad shadow on the ground. The view from here was unobstructed, but it revealed not a single house as far as the eye could see. Tengo guessed that a person would have to loathe human contact to build a home in such an inconvenient place. Turning the knob with a clatter, Fukairi walked in through the unlocked front door and signaled for Tengo to follow her. No one came out to greet them. They removed their shoes in the quiet, almost too large front entry hall. The glossy wooden floor of the corridor felt cool against stocking feet as they walked down it to the large reception room. The windows there revealed a panoramic view of the mountains and of a river meandering far below, the sunlight reflecting on its surface. It was a marvelous view, but Tengo was in no mood to enjoy it. Fukairi sat him down on a large sofa and left the room without a word. The sofa bore the smell of a distant age, but just how distant Tengo could not tell. The reception room was almost frighteningly free of decoration. There was a low table made from a single thick plank. Nothing lay on it, no ashtray, no tablecloth. No pictures adorned the walls, no clocks, no calendars, no vases, no sideboard, no magazines, no books. The floor had an antique rug so faded that its pattern could not be discerned, and the sofa and easy chairs seemed just as old. There was nothing else, just the large raft-like sofa on which Tengo was sitting, and three matching chairs. There was a large open-style fireplace, but it showed no signs of having contained a fire recently. For a mid-April morning, the room was downright chilly, as if the cold that had seeped in through the winter had decided to stay for a while. Many long months and years seemed to have passed since the room had made up its mind never to welcome any visitors. Fukairi returned and sat down next to Tengo, still without speaking. Neither of them said anything for a long time. Fukairi shut herself up in her own enigmatic world, while Tengo tried to calm himself with several quiet, deep breaths. Except for the occasional distant bird cry, the room was hushed. Tengo listened to the silence, which seemed to offer several different meanings. It was not simply an absence of sound. The silence seemed to be trying to tell him something about itself. For no reason, he looked at his watch. Raising his face, he glanced at the view outside the window, and then looked at his watch again. Hardly any time had passed. Time always passed slowly on Sunday mornings. 10 minutes went by like this. Then suddenly, without warning, the door opened, and a thinly built man entered the reception room with nervous footsteps. He was probably in his mid-60s. He was no taller than 5'3", but his excellent posture prevented him from looking unimpressive. His back was as straight as if it had a steel rod in it, and he kept his chin pulled in smartly. His eyebrows were bushy, and he wore black, thick-framed glasses that seemed to have been made to frighten people. His movements suggested an exquisite machine with parts designed for compactness and efficiency. Tengo started to stand and introduce himself, but the man quickly signaled for him to remain seated. Tengo sat back down while the man rushed to lower himself into the facing easy chair, as if in a race with Tengo. For a while, the man simply stared at Tengo, saying nothing. His gaze was not exactly penetrating, but his eyes seemed to take in everything, narrowing and widening like a camera's diaphragm when the photographer adjusts the aperture. The man wore a deep green sweater over a white shirt and dark gray woolen trousers. Each piece looked as if it had been worn daily for a good 10 years or more. They conformed to his body well enough, but they were also a bit threadbare. This was not a person who paid a great deal of attention to his clothes, nor perhaps did he have people close by who did it for him. The thinness of his hair emphasized the rather elongated shape of his head from front to back. He had sunken cheeks and a square jaw. A plump child's tiny lips were the one feature of his that did not quite match the others. His razor had missed a few patches on his face, or possibly it was just the way the light struck him. The mountain sunlight pouring through the windows seemed different from the sunlight Tengo was used to seeing. "I'm sorry I made you come all this way," the man said. He spoke with an unusually clear intonation, like someone long accustomed to public speaking, and probably about logical topics. It's not easy for me to leave this place, so all I could do was ask you to go to the trouble of coming here. Tango said it was no trouble at all. He told the man his name and apologized for not having a business card. My name is Ebisuno, the man said. I don't have a business card either. Mr. Ebisuno? Tango asked. Everybody calls me Professor. I don't know why, but even my own daughter calls me Professor. What characters do you write your name with? It's an unusual name. I hardly ever see anybody else with it. Eri, write the characters for him, will you? Fukaeri nodded, took out a kind of notebook, and slowly, painstakingly, wrote the characters for Tengo on a blank sheet with a ballpoint pen. The Ebisu part was the character normally used for ancient Japan's wild northern tribes. The No was just the usual character for field. The way Fukaeri wrote them, the two characters could have been scratched into a brick with a nail, though they did have a certain style of their own. In English, my name could be translated as Field of Savages, perfect for a cultural anthropologist, which is what I used to be. The professor's lips formed something akin to a smile, but his eyes lost none of their attentiveness. I cut my ties with the research life a very long time ago, though. Now I'm doing something completely different. I'm living in a whole new field of savages. To be sure, the professor's name was an unusual one, but Tengo found it familiar. He was fairly certain there had been a famous scholar named Ebisuno in the late 60s who had published a number of well-received books. He had no idea what the books were about, but the name, at least, remained in some remote corner of his memory. Somewhere along the way, though, he had stopped encountering it. "I think I've heard your name before," Tengo said tentatively. "Perhaps," the professor said, looking off into the distance as if speaking about someone not present. "In any case, it would have been a long time ago." Tengo could sense the quiet breathing of Fukaeri seated next to him. Slow, deep breathing. Tengo Kawana, the professor said, as if reading a name tag. That's right, Tengo said. You majored in mathematics in college, and now you teach math at a cram school in Yoyogi, the professor said. But you also write fiction. That's what Eri tells me. Is that about right? Yes, it is, Tengo said. You don't look like a math teacher. You don't look like a writer, either. Tengo gave him a strained smile and said, Somebody said exactly the same thing to me the other day. It's probably my build. I didn't mean it in a bad sense, the professor said, pressing back the bridge of his black-framed glasses. There's nothing wrong with not looking like something. It just means you don't fit the stereotype yet. I'm honored to have you say that. I'm not a writer yet. I'm still just trying to write fiction. Trying. It's still trial and error for me. I see, the professor said. Then, as if he had just noticed the chilliness of the room, he rubbed his hands together. I've also heard that you're going to be revising the novella that Eri wrote in the hopes that she can win a literary magazine's New Writers Prize. You're planning to sell her to the public as a writer. Is my interpretation correct? That is basically correct, Tengo said. An editor named Komatsu came up with the idea. I don't know if the plan is going to work or not, or whether it's even ethical. My only role is to revise the style of the work, Air Chrysalis. I'm just a technician. Komatsu is responsible for everything else. The professor concentrated on his thoughts for a while. In the hushed room, Tengo could almost hear his brain working. The professor then said, This editor, Mr. Komatsu, came up with the idea, and you're cooperating with him on the technical side. Correct. I've always been a scholar, and, to tell you the truth, I've never read fiction with much enthusiasm. I don't know anything about customary practice in the world of writing and publishing fiction, but what you people are planning to do sounds to me like a kind of fraud. Am I wrong about that? No, you are not wrong. It sounds like fraud to me, too, Tengo said. The professor frowned slightly. You yourself obviously have ethical doubts about this scheme,
and still you are planning to go along with it, out of your own free will. Well, it's not exactly my own free will, but I am planning to go along with it. That is correct. And why is that? That's what I've been asking myself again and again all week, Tengo said honestly. The professor and Fukaeri waited in silence for Tengo to continue. Reasoning, common sense, instinct, they are all pleading with me to pull out of this as quickly as possible. I'm basically a cautious, commonsensical kind of person. I don't like gambling or taking chances. If anything, I'm a kind of coward. But this is different. I just can't bring myself to say no to Komatsu's plan, as risky as it is. And my only reason is that I'm so strongly drawn to Air Chrysalis. If it had been any other work, I would have refused out of hand. The professor gave Tengo a quizzical look. In other words, you have no interest in the fraudulent part of the scheme, but you have a deep interest in the rewriting of the work. Is that it? Exactly. It's more than a deep interest. If Air Chrysalis has to be rewritten, I don't want to let anyone else do it. I see, the professor said. Then he made a face, as if he had accidentally put something sour in his mouth. I see. I think I understand your feelings in the matter. But how about this Komatsu person? What's he in it for? Money? Fame? To tell you the truth, I'm not sure what Komatsu wants, Tengo said. But I do think it's something bigger than money or fame. And what might that be? Well, Komatsu himself might not see it that way, but he is another person who is obsessed with literature. People like him are looking for just one thing, and that is to find, if only once in their lifetimes, a work that is unmistakably the real thing. They want to put it on a tray and serve it up to the world. The professor kept his gaze fixed on Tengo for a time. Then he said, "In other words, you and he have very different motives, motives that have nothing to do with money or fame. I think you're right. Whatever your motives might be, though, the plan is, as you said, a very risky one. If the truth were to come out at some point, it would be sure to cause a scandal, and the public censure would not be limited to you and Mr. Komatsu. It could deliver a fatal blow to Eri's life at the tender age of 17. That's the thing that worries me most about this." "And you should be worried," Tengo said with a nod. "You're absolutely right." The space between the professor's thick black eyebrows contracted half an inch. "But what you are telling me is that you want to be the one to rewrite Air Chrysalis, even if it could put Eri in some danger." "As I said before, that is because my desire comes from a place that reason and common sense can't reach. Of course, I would like to protect Eri as much as possible, but I can't promise that she would never be harmed by this. That would be a lie." "I see," the professor said. Then he cleared his throat, as if to mark a turning point in the discussion. "Well, you seem to be an honest person, at least. I'm trying to be as straightforward with you as I can." The professor stared at the hands resting on his knees, as if he had never seen them before. First he stared at the backs of his hands, and then he flipped them over and stared at his palms. Then he raised his face and said, "So does this editor, this Mr. Komatsu, think that his plan is really going to work?" "Komatsu's view is that there are always two sides to everything," Tengo said. "A good side and a not-so-bad side." The professor smiled. "A most unusual view. Is this Mr. Komatsu an optimist, or is he self-confident?" "Neither," Tengo said. "He's just cynical." The professor shook his head lightly. "When he gets cynical, he becomes an optimist. Or he becomes self-confident. Is that it?" "He might have such tendencies." "A hard man to deal with, it seems." "He's a pretty hard man to deal with," Tengo said. "But he's no fool." The professor let out a long, slow breath. Then he turned to Fukaeri. "How about it, Eri? What do you think of this plan?" Fukaeri stared at an anonymous point in space for a while. Then she said, "It's okay. In other words, you don't mind letting Mr. Kawana here rewrite Air Chrysalis?" "I don't mind," she said. "It might cause you a lot of trouble."
Fukaeri said nothing in response to this. All she did was tightly grip the collar of her cardigan together at the neck, but the gesture was a direct expression of her firm resolve. "She's probably right," the professor said, with a touch of